docket today, and that is Charter Oak Fire Insurance Company versus Gene Swanigan. And I understand that council have informed the clerk at the time that they would like to argue. So our clerk will announce the case and we will proceed.
Okay, Mr. Short, Mr. Roberts goes to argue for appellant, and Mr. Eric Ruiz to argue for appellant.
Mr. Stokes, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This is a workers' compensation case. It's an appeal from a decision of the Division of Workers' Compensation involving what is referred to in the practice as an extent of injury issue. The division determined that the claimant's compensable injury to a finger on the hand did not extend to and include two conditions, reflex sympathetic dystrophy and complex regional pain syndrome. The claimant appealed from that decision and bore the burden of proof under the Labor Code to establish compensability for those conditions, which meant that the claimant bore the burden of proof two things. First, that the conditions existed, and secondly, that there was a causal nexus between the conditions and the work-related accident. And under a number of decisions, going back to the Myers decision from the Supreme Court and earlier, the claimant bore that burden to prove that by expert testimony. Because under this record and under a decision from the San Antonio Court of Appeals, complex regional pain syndrome is a condition that is beyond the understanding of ordinary lay people and therefore requires expert testimony. Charter Oak maintains that the testimony in this case from the claimant's doctor is conclusory in nature because it does not rely upon a basis. It relies upon the doctor's statement that he relies simply upon his expertise and training.
How do you respond to Mr. Swanigan's argument that in question one in the court's charge that it basically assumes the existence of these two conditions?
That's probably a comment on the way of the evidence, actually, Your Honor, but there's no objection on the basis that it was
so
a comment.
There's no objection to the charge. Don't we measure the sufficiency of the evidence under the charge actually given?
Actually, what you do is you look at the things that the claimant was required to prove. And the claimant was required to prove the existence of the condition and a causal relationship. With no question having been asked about the existence of the condition under Rule 279, that fact will be deemed in favor of the judgment if there is any evidence to support it. And our position in this case is that because the testimony is conclusory, there is no evidence to support it. Were there some evidence, it would be a deemed finding in support of the judgment. We would not be able to argue that.
Since there was no evidence, did you file a motion for summary judgment?
Did not file a motion for summary judgment.
No.
I don't know that, Your Honor. I didn't try the case, and I don't. It certainly is something that could have been done, but it wasn't done, and the case went to trial. Dr. Graybill is the claimant's doctor and the focus of this case. Dr. Graybill's testimony in this case was that he did not recognize the only two authorities that came into evidence through testimony about a basis for discerning the existence of complex regional pain syndrome and reflex sympathetic dystrophy: the Guides to the Evaluation of Permanent Impairment, 4th edition and 5th edition. Dr. Graybill testified that he was not familiar with the 4th edition. He testified that he was not familiar with the 5th edition. There was also testimony that one of the diagnostic aids in finding this condition was based on objective diagnostic testing, plain film x-rays, and triple phase bone scans. Dr. Graybill testified that he was unaware whether the claimant in this case had actually had a triple phase bone scan, and that he did not review the plain film x-rays in this case before making his decision.
How do you respond to the chart on page 7 of Appellee's brief comparing the Graybill Mitchell?
There are eight elements. I'm sorry, Your Honor. There are eight diagnoses or diagnostic criteria that are listed in that chart. The eighth one, according to the undisputed testimony in this case, was not a hallmark or cardinal sign under the AMA guides. That's the transient response to stellate ganglion blocks. And that testimony comes from Dr. Mitchell at 3 Reporters Record 55. So that leaves you with the remaining seven symptoms or conditions. Symptom two, color changes, which the claimant in their brief maintains can be found to have existed at pages 16, 9 through 10, lines 9 through 10. Actually, at page 36, lines 10 through 13, what the doctor said is that since Mr. Swanigan is African American, I did not see big color changes in his skin. I don't know if I would quite honestly be able to tell the difference from someone who's Caucasian where it's easier to see. So rather than finding color changes, what Dr. Graybill found is he testified he could not see color changes in this case. The fourth finding that is listed on that table, atrophy of the musculature, allegedly was found on pages 26 to 27 of the record. If you go to page 27 of the record, you don't find that finding. What you find on page 36 of the record, though, according to Dr. Graybill's testimony, is that he does not recall any atrophy. He did not find any atrophy in this case. The fifth changes in the nail bed, which allegedly were supposed to have been observed in Dr. Graybill's testimony on page 25. If you look on page 25, you don't find changes in the nail bed on that page of the record. But if you go to page 35, lines 23 and 24, what you see is the question, how about changes in the color of the nail bed? And Dr. Graybill testified, I didn't document that. I don't recall. And then changes in the skin, which is the sixth finding. You go back to page 36, lines 10 through 13, in which the doctor said he didn't see a big color change in the skin. It does not come close to the record representation that is in the brief. And more importantly, what Dr. Mitchell said, and Dr. Mitchell is the doctor who testified according to what the guides say you have to find. Dr. Mitchell said you have to find
the guides just guides. They're not the end-all be-all. It's not the only way you can set the standard of care or a diagnosis, right?
They are the only basis that was offered in this record.
Besides training and experience.
Besides training and experience, which the Supreme Court has called ipsy dixa and has said cannot serve as a basis for... I'm saying that if a doctor, if there is a basis in the record and the doctor ignores the basis and says, all I'm relying upon is my training and experience, that is conclusory testimony, and according to the Pollock case from the Supreme Court, it's conclusory and it is no evidence.
What else is he going to rely on besides the training and experience?
Doctors can rely upon scientific medical journals. Doctors can rely upon scientific publications, such as the AMA guides in this case, which is what sets out the diagnostic criteria. And that's what the Supreme Court says in the Pollock case. Other problem in this case is the analytical gap, which Dr. Graybill has in his record. Dr. Graybill in this case actually was unaware in his testimony that the claimant had a prior crush injury to the finger, which at the time of his subsequent accident still had pins in it, even though it was years and years earlier. Dr. Graybill was also unaware of the fact that Mr. Swanigan had a diagnosis, which was an old diagnosis of Kosalja, which is type 2, reflex chronic regional pain syndrome. The doctor was asked to assume that he did not have those conditions And according to Supreme Court authority, the doctor has to rely upon the evidence in the case, not assumptions that are contrary to the evidence. And that's found in Mitchell Energy Corp. It's also found in Robinson. It is Burroughs Welcome versus Cry problem as well. It's also a problem under Schaefer versus TEI, or TEI versus Schaefer, the 1980 decision out of the Supreme Court. The testimony in this case is conclusory. It is not based upon a scientific basis. It is only based upon the doctor's statement that it is his training that supports it. And under Pollack, that is conclusory testimony. It is no evidence, and will not support a judgment on a no evidence point. We'll reserve the balance of our time, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel. This case is about Dr. Graybill. This opinion, this appeal is about Dr. Graybill. Dr. Graybill's opinions are not ipse dixit. Ipse dixit is, according to the Supreme Court, it's the basis of the witness's opinion alone that you look at. Dr. Graybill has testified, his credentials are in his testimony and included in the appellate record, about his long experience as an anesthesiologist, about his treatment of this very condition that Mr. Swanigan is requesting the insurance company compensate him for. Dr. Graybill and Dr. Williams, who is defendant's expert, both said anesthesiologists are the ones that treat this condition. Dr. Williams said, look, I can diagnose it. I don't treat it. I refer it to anesthesiologists. Those are the guys that do the work on this kind of condition. Dr. Graybill's opinions are not ipse dixit because he bases his opinions on objective signs that he finds on Mr. Swanigan. And I wanted to make that distinction. The record on page 7, the chart, is not showing the exact symptoms and signs that Dr. Graybill found on Mr. Swanigan. It's just meant to show, and I don't even put that in the brief, but it's meant to show that these are the same types of symptoms these doctors are looking for. They're saying that Dr. Graybill's opinions are not reliable, yet he is looking at the exact same things that Dr. Mitchell looks for in making this diagnosis. The same very signs and symptoms that are included in the American Medical Association 4th and 5th Guides to Physical Impairment. And Justice Walker, you were right. That is not a diagnostic manual. In fact, you will find very little diagnostic criteria in 95% of that book. That book is called The Guides to Physical Impairment because it's meant to apply a guide for these doctors to go in for someone in a workers' compensation setting and say, what is your impairment rating? What is your permanent physical impairment rating? And they look at these tests, and they look at these signs and symptoms, and they say, well, you're impairment rating fits within this criteria, therefore we're going to give you a 5% or a 10%. That's how these doctors assign an impairment rating. I have yet to see any doctor in a workers' compensation case ever use the AMA guides to actually diagnose a condition. In fact, if you read Dr. Williams' testimony, and I've noted that in my brief, he testifies that he actually uses the same information that Dr. Graybill uses, and he does not use a triple phase bone scan or an x-ray when trying to diagnose, and that is on the top of my brief on page 8, and the record you'll find that on volume 3, page 79, 18 through 22. So even their expert doesn't use a triple phase bone scan or an x-ray to diagnose this condition, yet they're expecting our expert to use what their expert doesn't use. In this regard,
before we get away from this, how do you respond to the opposing counsel's argument that basically it's well and fine that Dr. Graybill was looking for the list of diagnosed symptoms on page 7, but in fact he didn't find it?
And that also goes to the fact that the defendants did not object to Dr. Graybill ahead of time, and therefore they're attacking the reliability of his opinions, which in the Coastal case and in the City of San Antonio case, the Supreme Court says you can't attack the reliability of an expert's opinions after he's testified. You have to make that assertion before his testimony so that the trial judge can be the gatekeeper. With regard to your question, and admittedly, I was looking for that today, and I didn't make a copy of the testimony, so I'm not exactly sure that I can answer your question. I know that Dr. Graybill did not find every single one of these. I know that he found the hallmark signs and symptoms, which are the temperature changes, the color changes, I believe the sweating he did find. I believe Mr. Stokes is correct that he did not find changes in the nail bed, but did testify to some changes in the skin. And it was, that's not skin color, that is simply changes in the skin, in the surface of the skin, because the skin can become, on this condition, it can become shiny, is what Dr. Graybill and Dr. Williams said. And I think if you look where I've quoted, that those are the actual signs and symptoms that doctors use to diagnose the condition, not that they found every one. With regard...
Dr. Graybill was a treating physician of Mr. Flanagan, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And so, are there any cases that you know of where an opinion that a treating doctor that... I mean, my understanding is that the Supreme Court cases that say that testimony, expert testimony is conclusory, they define conclusory typically as not based on the facts in the record. In other words, it's conclusory because the expert just says benzene causes cancer, and it's not based on, it's not tied to facts, and that's what makes it conclusory. So are you aware of any cases where the testimony of a treating expert has been held to be conclusory when it's based on his examination of the patient?
None, Your Honor. I've not made that type of analysis, but in the cases that I've looked at, and I think specifically, I guess you're talking about the City of San Antonio versus Pollock with the benzene, that was a hired expert. I typically don't, this is a more or less a pro bono case for me. I don't get paid on this. So I don't have a lot of hired experts in these cases, and I have to rely upon treating physicians. And with regard to the erroneous jury charge, I believe that the court is limited to the charge presented to the jury and the jury's determination of that charge. And in this case, clearly the question says Mr. Swanigan's RSD CRPS. And that is not a question. And if you read through the record, I actually said to the trial judge, I said, Judge, I think we need to change this and make it a two-part question. We need to say, does Mr. Swanigan have this condition? And if so, was this condition caused by his work activity? The appellant jumped up and said, no, 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 that's not what we want. We want this to read the way we have it in our charge, proposed charge, and the judge went with their proposed charge. And if you read the way it's worded, I believe that you will agree that it does presuppose the existence of the condition. It says, do you find from a preponderance of the evidence that Gene Swanigan's injury of May 18, 2006 was a producing cause of Gene Swanigan's reflex sympathetic dystrophy complex regional pain syndrome? So that's presupposing that he has the condition, and the only question the jury answered was the injury a producing cause of the condition? With regard to the producing cause testimony, if you look on page 10 of my brief, I note that I asked Dr. Graybill about a 2001 crush injury. Mr. Swanigan had an injury to the same pinky with screws holding it together in 2001. He had surgery on that finger. Subsequent to that injury, he got a job at CarMax, where he was asked, and he testifies to this as well, and I've got it in my brief, volume 2, page 32 and 33, that he was asked routinely to lift 110 to 120 pound transmissions for approximately the 5 years that he worked at CarMax, from April 29, 2001 to May 18, 2006. Mr. Swanigan was also asked in his testimony about any problems that he had in his pinky after this surgery and while he was working at CarMax before his injury at on the job that we're here about today. His exact testimony, which is on in Volume 2, page 31, 24 to 32, 13, is he said, I never did have any problems. I posed that exact hypothetical to Dr. Graybill, and I said, Dr. Graybill, assume for me that he had this surgery in 2001. On Volume 3, page 36, 14 through page 37, 1, I said, Dr. Graybill, assume that he had this injury in 2001, he had this surgery, but that he's testified that he did not have any lingering symptoms from this injury. Given that assumption, do you find that his work injury is a producing cause of a CRPS RSD? Dr. Graybill said yes. That is not an incorrect statement of fact from the record. There is no assertion, there's no evidence of any other producing cause of this condition but this, potentially this 2001 injury and the on-the-job injury. I don't know that I am under any sort of duty to impeach my own expert and bring up a whole host of potential causes. I would assure that defense counsel would be in that role and that he or she would be the ones to say, well, what about this, Dr. Graybill? Did you consider this? And I don't even know what this would be at this point, judges. I'm just throwing that out there that I don't feel like I'm under any duty to try and impeach my own expert on other potential causes, but to ask him, given these set of circumstances and this hypothetical, which is accurate to the facts of the case. So with that, I don't think I have much more to say. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll start out by asking you the exact same question. You're probably ready for it. But are you aware of any case law where a treating physician testimony?
I haven't looked at it from exactly that perspective, Your Honor, but with the court's permission, I will. And with the court's permission, I'll submit a very short letter brief with those citations.
That would be excellent.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, you'll have the opportunity to respond within 10 days of whatever
Let me address the final part of counsel's argument first, in which he said that it's the defendant's duty to, or the carrier's duty to sort of impeach the claimant's expert by exploring other possible causes. In Robinson and Havner both, the Supreme Court has said that if the evidence presents other possible causes of the condition that could be negated, the proponent of the testimony, and in this case it would be the claimant, must offer evidence excluding those causes within reasonable certainty.
But his question was, you proffered says A, producing cause, not B, producing cause.
That's correct.
So if he proved that it was A, producing cause, that requires an affirmative answer from the jury, regardless of other possible.
Actually not, Your Honor, with respect, under Robinson and Havner, if it can be negated, it is the proponent's burden to negate other possible causes. And under the
crop... I'm hearing it. I'm totally hearing it. It said was the producing cause. He's got to eliminate all those other possible causes. That's not what's here.
And under the Crump standard for producing cause, a producing cause must be a substantial cause, and under Havner and Robinson, the proponent of the testimony must negate other possible causes if it can be.
Tell me how to do that. What other possible causes were there other than the previously pinned or crushed finger?
That is the other possible cause in this case, and the expert on which the claimant relies did not attempt to negate that. And under Havner and Robinson, that's...
Well, we just heard that he exactly negated it by assuming the testimony that she'd already come from the claimant.
but he didn't go further and ask the doctor to assume the contrary, which was also in evidence. That's correct. Dr. Dierenberger's record indicated that the claimant had been diagnosed with complex regional pain syndrome after his crush injury in 2000. And the claimant bears the burden not only to establish that cause occurs from the injury that he proposed, but also to negate the injury from the other possible cause. That's what Robinson says. That's what Havner says. It may be a difficult burden, but it's what the Supreme Court has placed on a plaintiff in a case like this. And it's black letter law from Robinson and Havner. In this case, there is a question that has been raised about objections to the testimony of Dr. Graybill in this case. Read Pollack at pages 816 through 818. Here's what the Supreme Court says about objections. They say there are two types of cases. There are cases where an objection must be lodged, and there are cases where an objection need not be lodged. An objection must be lodged where the objection is on the basis that the basis for the doctor's opinion is unreliable. That is, had the doctor come in this case and said, I'm relying upon the second edition of the AMA guides, and our position, if it had been that that's an unreliable basis for the doctor's opinion, we must raise that before the court, or we waive our right to challenge that as a reliable basis. But the court says if no basis for the opinion is offered, which is the case here, or the basis offered provides no support, the opinion is merely a conclusory statement and cannot be considered probative evidence regardless of whether there is an objection. That's the case here. This is an ipsy-dixit opinion. It is an opinion that has no basis to it other than the doctor's statement that he says, I'm a doctor, trust me. The Supreme Court recognizes that the ipsy-dixit rule applies even when the doctor is credentialed. Pollack says that a claim will not stand or fall on the mere ipsy-dixit of a credentialed witness. We respectfully request that the court reverse the judgment, render judgment in favor of the appellee, and for such other and further relief to which we may have shown ourselves entitled.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Marie. Thank you all, and thank you for traveling here from Austin.
Yes, ma'am.
We appreciate your arguments and your briefing before the court today. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go about your business.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals.